Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm going to talk just a little bit about our cover story, what it means, what it is, why we might want to pay a lot of attention to it, and sometimes figure out how to override it and sneak in our undercover. And I'm going to play two interviews of mystery writers that I interviewed at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention. That's Wayne Balcom and Terry Griffin. So hang on, here come the show. To The Lynn Show, which is today being brought to you by Asheville Hot Air Balloons in Asheville, North Carolina. Are you overwhelmed by all the unexpected things that are happening in our world? As a therapist, I know that one of the best ways to deal with difficult problems is sometimes just to take a break from them. And there is no better break than getting up above it all in a hot air balloon. Your burdens will lift, your perspective will change, and you'll feel liberated. It's fun, it's therapeutic, and it's cheaper than therapy. Tell them that you heard about Asheville Hot Air Balloons on The Lynn Show, and contact Asheville Hot Air Balloons either at their website, AshevilleHotAirBalloons.com, or call them at 828-667-9943. That's 828-667-9943. Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. Today, I'm not going to be able to talk too much about what gets between us and the things we want to do and be, because today I'm spending three quarters of this show airing two interviews that I did with mystery writers who I interviewed at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention. Although I usually spend the first half of the show talking about why we can't do what we want to do, why we can't be all that we are, I'm only going to just talk a little bit about that today. If you want to learn more about the show, what I do, listen to old shows, you can get that information on my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Last week, I said that I was going to talk about our cover story. Cover story, I've called it cover story because it really is like what a spy has. It is a pretense that is all we are. Now, spies are quite often making the whole thing up. For us, a cover story is usually the truth. It's just not the whole truth. We present parts of ourselves and hide other parts of ourselves. In order to maintain balance, families carefully teach each child the role that he or she has to play. That role, which is essential to the smooth functioning of the family, becomes your and mine cover story. So I'm going to talk about how you created your cover story and how it is your reluctance to blow your cover that can stop you from making even the most important changes in your life. Everyone has a cover story. It's a detailed explanation of who you are and who you're not. You create this story to satisfy what you understand to be your family's requirements. That is, what they expect of you, what they demand of you, who they think you are, or who they need you to be. Because you base your cover on who you believe your family wants you to be, and not on who you actually are, your cover story isn't strictly accurate. That is to say, the pieces of it that you're showing are real, but there's more of you. In your cover story, you admit to having certain qualities while you deny others. The qualities you acknowledge, your cover, are qualities you can use. The qualities that you deny go undercover and become unavailable to you. This story generally works quite well within the context of your family. And as long as the changes that you want to make in life only require you to use the cover traits that you have accepted and demonstrated as your own, then you can make these changes quite easily. But when what you want to do requires you to expose traits you've hidden under cover, you can get stuck. That what we've been thinking of as just me may not be the whole story. And there may be reasons, important reasons, for surfacing, recognizing, and demonstrating our undercover. I'm going to talk more about why we hold on so tight to our cover story, how we can discover what our undercover might be, and how to demonstrate it if we need it. But right now, I'm going to go right to my interviews. The first interview is with Wayne Balcom. He's a mystery writer, as I said. And he has a kind of interesting story. So here, Wayne Balcom. So I'm sitting here in a room at the Lido Beach Hotel with Wayne Balcom at the Mystery Writers Convention in Sarasota, Florida. And Wayne and I don't know each other or anything about each other. For the radio show, I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist. Mm-hmm. And I interview people who make their living or their life with their art. Mm-hmm. And I always start out by asking them the thing that's most compelling to me, and that is, how did you find it? How did it find you? How did it capture you? How did it start?
How did who find me? The
Your work.
Well, that's a long story, but I'll give it to you in brief. I was always writing ever since I was a kid, and I wrote all through high school and college. But I also wanted to make some money. So
did somebody tell you that those two things didn't go together?
Well, I by that time I was smart enough to know that that's not going to make me rich. So I went into the college textbook publishing business, and I eventually became president of one company, and then I left and founded my own company, which was sold to a huge conglomeration, and I stayed with them on the board of directors. But I was still writing all the time.
Well, and you didn't leave writing, really. You
no,
just
I
found
stayed
a way.
From that standpoint, sure. And I knew a lot about publishing as a result. But that's finally, I felt about, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago that I had could afford to leave the rat race and finally devote my life full-time to writing. And so I began 10 minutes after that. We moved down here to Florida, and I began writing a novel, and I had a tough time getting it published and all, and then I had learned my craft from that book, and I went on and I wrote another book and immediately got that published, and it became, it was a thriller, and it did very well, but people were, my wife and I had really gotten used to Sarasota, and she had come from California, from San Francisco, and I from the Boston area, and we, you know, it took us some time to get used to Florida, mm-hmm. and Sarasota and all, and gradually it grew on us, and you know, we came to love it. One day it was my wife, Susan, who said, well, why don't you do your next book based here in Sarasota? You got a lot of insights into it, a lot of feelings about it, both pro and con. But you pour it all in. So I did. I created a character based on myself, a guy who came down to Florida from Boston. I let it all fly about my reactions, my feelings about it. Again, both pro and con. And Sam Wallace was the character's name, and he had a lot of my characteristics, the same old 1969 Mercedes 280 SE convertible, which is a very rare car, and he tools around on that. He had a little dog named Henry, like we did. And
so this was pretty easy to write.
It was great. It was great fun writing that. And, excuse me, and it did very, very well. So my agent and my publisher asked me to quickly do another one, and
follow
I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then my agent asked me to do a more noir kind of book. It was set in New York City, which I did, and just came out last...
did you use the same character, or you...
A totally different book. Mm-hmm. Totally different book with a new character. That came out in April of this year. And now I've just finished the third Sam Wallace book.
Oh, that's great.
The one set in Sarasota. And I'm mailing that off to my agent on Monday. Maybe tomorrow, it's tomorrow, Saturday, mm-hmm. either tomorrow or Monday. And that'll be the third one on that book. And then I've got about half done on the other series that's set in New York City. So I'm going to try to alternate back and forth between these two. But I must say, don't tell my agent this, but my real love is these Sarasota books. It's funny. There are loads of highly successful books that are set in Florida. Florida mm-hmm. is a great hunting ground for... crazy, kooky people down here, and great setting, a sense of place, and that's where I've gotten hooked on writing these Sam books,
mm-hmm.
but my agent is a New York guy, and my publishers are in New York, and it's still hard to...
They don't get it.
Yeah, they like the stuff, the heavy noir stuff that's set in New York.
Darker, much darker.
So I'm going back and forth on those.
Well, it's great that you're flexible in that way.
Yeah, I am flexible. I labor hard over the noir
books.
New York-based books, like The Hunted, that just came out. It's about a female serial killer who's prowling around the city. She's deranged, but she's functioning very, very well, highly well-educated, but something had happened in the first chapter of the book when she was 8 years old that just... you know, made her snap, but somehow or other she's been able to cover it up, and then something happens 20 years later, which makes her snap again, and then she goes on from there. So, without digressing too much, I worked hard on trying to make this young woman, who's about 28 or 29, who, and when she's normal, she's a delight, and I tried so hard to make it realistic that this person could morph into a real kid. Well, to my wonderment and surprise and delight, I read a review about a month ago on a website called Daytime and Nighttime, and it focuses on movie and book reviews. And the review was very, very positive, and the reviewer, who was a woman, went on to say... how the character was great because you could, even though she was a killer, you could empathize with her and feel for her and really connect with her. That, my God.
Yes, they got it.
Yeah.
They got it.
Yeah.
Also, sociopaths, which is what this woman has to be, quite often are very plausible. I mean, they're quite often when they're not in their disease.
They can
it's psychologically accurate as well.
And I must say that I did a fair amount, quite a bit of research on this, too, to determine whether or not what I was trying to do with this person would be realistic.
Would make sense.
And what
would
you just said from a psychotherapist standpoint,
right.
You agree that it can be.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, I mean, this isn't rocket science. Everybody knows this. But it is your capacity to see the person as not unidimensional that makes you interested in the character. You know, that compels you, that keeps you.
What I try to do in this book, there are a number of young women comparable to the woman who turns out to be the killer.
A lot of red herrings?
Pardon?
Red herrings?
Yeah, a lot of them. And they're all somewhat similar. They're professionals, they're college educated, they work in a professional capacity in New York City, they're likable, and there are a number of them in there who float in and out, and so they're not just dropped in,
mm-hmm.
and they have a role. And that's what I try to do, so that at the end, I'm delighted to have people say, gee, they just knocked me for a loop when I found out who the killer was.
That's great.
Of course, that's what you want to do when you're out of mystery.
That's right. That's right. It's very hard, I think.
Yeah.
I read a lot of mysteries, and so I know it, you know, about halfway through, I'm already beginning to decide.
Well, there's a man whom I met. I thought I read a lot because I write. And I maybe read 60 books a year, which is a lot for me because I spend most of my time writing. But there's a guy that came to one of the signings that I did. It was a talk that I gave at someplace. And we got talking afterwards, and he was raving about how much he loved that ending. And he said, it just knocked me out. He said, I was amazed. And his wife said, yeah, and he reads all the time. He reads a lot. Yeah. I said, well, how many books do you read? And he says, oh, about 300 a year.
Oh, my gosh.
Guy,
he must do nothing else.
That way he's retired. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she said, he just gobbles them up. She said, he can sit down and read a book in practically one sitting.
He pretty much has to.
Yeah, and I mean, I can't do that.
No.
Most people can't.
I can't do that.
But it really thrilled me when he said that he couldn't figure it out because this guy's read everything.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Okay, so I have some questions about, I'd like to go back, if you don't mind, to, you said you wrote all the way through high school.
Yeah.
When did you start? Do you remember what turned you on? What made you want to write? What you were writing?
I don't know. I mean, I came from a blue-collar family.
You did?
Neither my mother nor my father graduated from high school. I don't know. I just had something in me that I was curious all the time. I'd see things. I'd write about them. I don't know where it came from. Nobody in my family background that ever did any writing.
And did they have an opinion about the fact that you were writing all the time? Did they know? Did you hide it?
Oh, no, I didn't have to hide it, no.
But they didn't say, what are you doing?
It wasn't something they could identify with.
No.
And then when I it's funny, you know how you look back on influences.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a junior in high school, I had a teacher named John Riley. Mr. Riley, and he was the guy who really, because he saw that, he said, you got a lot of talent, Wayne, and I was, 15 years old, and he's the guy who really got me interested in writing, and got me reading stuff, and he would come to class, and he would enact Cyrano de Bergerac, and put a cape on, and use a ruler for a sword, through the discussions with him after class and all, that really got me turned on. And I'd write different stuff, little stories and things.
Well, you know, I mean, this isn't so odd to say, but you're a Boston kid from a blue-collar family. Most of these guys are not spending their time writing short stories.
Yeah, but I did.
I know.
Yeah, my brother's totally different.
Well, it is kind of an anomaly, you know.
Yeah.
That's why it's so interesting.
Yeah. Because my brother's totally different. He became a successful real estate executive, but never had any interest. I think my brother Bill probably reads 2 books a year. It's just not his thing.
No.
But he's smart, and he's hardworking and all. But where I got it from, I don't know. But I always read. I read plays.
See that it's somehow anomalous.
I had an artistic bent somewhere inside.
Clearly, you did.
Yeah, because I've acted in probably 50 plays or more.
Yeah,
I write theater reviews.
Yeah.
I wrote book reviews for the Boston newspapers on a freelance basis.
So you don't know whether anybody in your extended family, one of your parents' siblings or something, nothing. It just came
nothing
to you from nothing. That's really interesting. It's really interesting.
But it's not. I don't think it's rare. You know, there are a lot of really great writers who are enormously successful who came from similar backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, maybe most of them, the old time writers.
Maybe a kind of way to make sense of your life.
You know, a guy like Mickey Spillane, for example.
I know.
There are a lot of guys like that who came from not very
literate.
Educated backgrounds, literate backgrounds.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So the other question occurred to me while you were talking was, you said you wrote your first book, it was very difficult and it was hard to get it published,
yeah.
But you learned your craft from writing it. How did that happen? I mean, what was it about, what did you learn and how did you learn it from writing?
Oh, boy. I mean, I looked back at that. I mean, it was full of extra adjectives and adverbs and long sentences and so much extraneous stuff. That it just rambled on and on. It had a terrific plot, and there was nothing wrong with that, but it was the writing, and that's what you learn. You either have enough imagination to create a plot or you don't.
You don't, right, right.
No, you can watch TV, you can watch all these gangster movies and stuff, but if you don't have the imagination, it's not going to work. But I had that, but I was still writing like a kid almost, you know, and I just didn't have a style, and gradually I developed my style.
How did you know that you had all this extraneous stuff? I mean, did they edit you?
Okay. Here's my secret weapon.
Oh, okay.
I forgot to mention my secret
weapon.
Oh,
all right. Good.
Okay. This is the big deal. my wife, Susan, spent 15 years in the publishing industry and was a senior editor at two of them.
I see.
At three publishers. And Susan is a genius.
Yeah.
And if anybody has turned me into the writer I am today, it's really Susan. I was ready to send off the third Sam book to my agent in New York 2 months ago. I was ready, and I said, it's ready.
It's ready.
It's ready.
And she said, well.
She just climbed all over it,
yeah,
and saved my fanny.
Mm-hmm.
And as recently as this morning, when it's going off, I
right.
thought, tomorrow or Monday,
right.
as
right.
recently as this morning,
right.
she came charging me. Wayne, I just went over this, and she, you know, saw some things that needed doing. Something
right.
that, minor things.
Right.
Something had been said on page 32.
That didn't make
the
sense
same
on
thing
page,
was
right.
wrote, but the same thing was repeated on page 150.
Oh, yeah.
I said, ooh, God, it's stuff like that.
Yes.
So when you send a manuscript into an agent and or the poet, it's got to be perfect, letter
yeah.
perfect.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he just won't bother with it. So she really has been my secret weapon. So if I learned how to write, that's when she and I got married, which was, by the way, coincidental with when my career started to take off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
She's not my first wife. We've been married for about 17 years, and that's about when, you know, I started really learning my...
So it's really a blending for you two of not only that you love each other, but that you have this passion and interest.
Oh, we have this fascinating, fabulous interaction all the time. We lie in bed, you know, going over stuff like this.
Yes.
We do it all the time.
That's great.
And it is. It's just terrific. And I learned so much from her, and she thinks I'm the greatest writer in the whole world.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we... But just as I said again this morning, she came charging upstairs. I work in my office upstairs, and she first time came charging up and started
you
chewing my
You didn't see this, right?
Oh, yeah. So she's great.
It's great.
I should have asked her to join me in this. But
well, another time.
Yeah.
Okay. do you want to say anything about the conference?
Yeah, this is the fifth one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been at every one of them. And they're all very good. They get some of the best writers in Florida, and I really give Terry and his group credit for the quality of people they get. Last year they had Michael Connelly as the keynote speaker, and they get some really good, they have some other great keynote speakers, and it's fun, it's a lot of fun. The people who come always, I know a lot of the people from around Sarasota who come, and they love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they do a terrific job. I've been to other writers' conferences, and this is much more intimate. And if I were here as a person who wanted to learn about writing,
mm-hmm,
and get to talk with the writers, I would think this, I'd put this head and shoulders, because it's intimate.
Is there anything I didn't ask you that you'd like me to ask you, or anything you want to say about making a living or a life as an artist?
Oh, okay. Now, that's a very good point. My books are successful, and My agent has sold foreign rights to many different foreign countries. He's negotiating. He has his own agent out in Hollywood with whom he's, or that guy has been negotiating, but that's, you know, it goes on for on and on forever. But in spite of all of that, if I didn't have other sources of income from my business world, I wouldn't be living as well as I do.
Right.
And I think that's true with a great majority of writers, except for maybe the top 5%.
Right.
And so
don't give up your day gig.
Yeah, that's, you know, that old cliche, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
But I was lucky. I had enough outside sources of income that I could take that plunge and do what I've always, you know, wanted to do.
Yes.
But I never would have done it if I thought I was going to have to live on it.
Wow.
It's more and more difficult. Now, I was just talking with a colleague who was with a major publisher, and his books, I've read them, and they're terrific. But he was just bitching about his publisher, who's a first, you know, rate publisher, that with each book, no matter how well the previous one did, they kept cutting back on the first printing, on the printing.
Yes.
And kept cutting back and telling him, hey, you know, it's the economy and so forth. So as he said, he just fired him. And he said, I started my own company and all. So it's not easy today in the publishing world, in the writing world.
No, I don't. I don't think it really ever has been, but I think, as you say, the economy has made it worse.
It's like everything else in the economy, and
yeah,
publishing
right.
is just a part of it.
Right. Well, and publishing is having its own problems with the internet and all that.
Absolutely.
So they're in, you know.
I mean, my book is 25 or $26.95. 10 minutes after it was published, I see Amazon and all got them on there, brand new ones for $16.
Right.
And all of it.
Right.
I still haven't figured that out unless I finally decided they must buy them from the publisher at the disc, some kind of a discount.
Yeah, right.
And then they can sell it at rock bottom. I just don't know how they do it. But. And then immediately they have used copies. We have done, the first book I ever published, here's another thing I can't figure out. The first book I ever published, it's out of print now and everything. I see that offered for sale on an Amazon and Barnes & Noble for $100, $120. Look up sometime in any book, and you will see that. And
that you don't get any...
Well, no,
because
I don't
it's
get
out of,
anything
because
out of,
it's out of print, because the money's not going to the publisher, it's going to whoever's selling it.
Yeah. These are resales, you know?
Yeah, right.
And some jerk thinks that he or she is going to get
$100 for this book.
Because it's a signed copy or something.
Oh, my God.
You wouldn't get that with a signed copy of
right.
Stephen King on anybody.
Right.
But you see them all the time.
That's fascinating.
If the spirit ever moves you, just take a look. Look up any book and you'll see some that are being used books offered for $100, $125. Books that are $24, $25. New.
Really odd, isn't it?
Yeah, so anyway, that's a long-winded response to your question about, you know, making it, that was something about your question, and it's, you know, it's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
You get a tremendous ego kick out of it, doing something that you love.
Yes.
And now my books are all filled up the front window of Barnes & Noble here, and you get a kick out of that,
mm-hmm.
and get all kinds of emails from people, and all the writers do, and you love that. And the money's fun, too.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, if you're going to do it to make a living, it's like David Hagberg here. David is very successful. He's under the gun with his publisher to get out 2 books a year.
Wow.
That's...
Wow.
This book that I just had published, it took me a year, over a year, after I thought it was all done and finished of rewrites, where I had spent about a year and a half on the first one. And he's under the gun to do 2 books a year.
Yeah, it's
I mean,
lot.
I couldn't do that.
Well, okay, so one last time. Anything else that you want to say about writing, being a writer, being a mystery writer? I didn't ask that. Why mystery?
Well, that's a very good question, again.
Mm.
And we have a panel tomorrow talking about the differences. Are you going to be here tomorrow?
I may be. When is it?
It's 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
But the panel, the point of it is the differences between cozies and mysteries and thrillers.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points that I'm going to make is I think it's easier to write a thriller. My first book was a thriller. This new one, St. Martin's calls it The Hunted, a thriller. But it's really a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I think it's easier to write a thriller is, or put it the other way, the reason it's more difficult to write a mystery is you have to really carefully craft this so that the reader doesn't know who the killer is, and it's not easy to do. And you have to have all these clues. It's a procedural thing.
Right.
And I have to keep coming up with, see, where can my guy find another clue and stuff. And that's whereas with the thriller, if you got a really good plot, it just flows along. You don't have to worry about clues.
Yeah.
I find it easier. I mean, I'm writing mysteries now because I've gotten into it and I know how to do it. But that first book that was a thriller just rolled off me, and it was much easier to write.
So what's a cozy, then?
A cozy is a... did you ever watch the Miss Marple?
Oh, yeah, I've read all that stuff.
Yeah, and it's almost always a woman. She's not part of a law enforcement. She's on her own, like Miss Fletcher.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Angela Lansbury.
Right,
you know.
Right.
She's a classic case. The murders are never graphic.
Right.
They're never described. They're never described in great detail. They're soft and gentle. That's a cozy. And it's primarily 99.9% of the readers are women.
Yes. Hold on a second. I think we have to stop.
We have to set this room up for a wedding.
Okay. We'll be done in a second. Thank you. Okay, I think we...
What did he say?
They have to set the room for a wedding. Pretty small wedding. Anyway, Wayne, thank you very much.
Okay.
This was great.
Yeah,
it was informative and it was interesting, and okay. I'm wishing you a hell of a lot of luck.
So as you could hear, we were in a room in the hotel that we weren't supposed to be in, and they needed it for a wedding. This comes up a lot in my interviews because... I had to keep trying to find spaces to interview, and sometimes they were not, well, never mind. Anyway, that was Wayne Balcom, and he did talk a great deal about what it means to be a writer, which I found absolutely fascinating. Also, I wonder if you heard that you heard him say that his teacher, early on, John Riley, if you're listening, who told him that he had talent. And that stayed with him and captured him and made him take his interest in writing seriously. If you were listening last week, I did a memorial to Kenny Rankin, and Kenny says that Miss Pringle, who came over to him in the fourth grade and patted him on the head, and said, "Kenneth, that was lovely," what he had just sung for a pageant. And that focused him on his career. So if any of you teachers are listening, it has an impact. It matters what you do. And, of course, it doesn't have to be teachers. Parents can do this, too. And in both of these cases, it was casual. It wasn't a big deal. They weren't trying to turn these people into writers or performers. They were simply commenting that that thing that the kid did deserved credit, stood out, was valuable, interesting, lovely. So, next I'm going to play another interview that I did at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention with Terry Griffin, who also had a career before he became a writer. Actually, pretty much everybody I interviewed there did. And they all make the same point. Also, unfortunately, don't give up your day gig. If you're captured by writing, it's not necessarily a lucrative field. Anyway, Terry Griffin was a trial lawyer, and he will talk about that and his own path to mystery writing. So before I play Terry's interview, I'm going to do a small public service announcement and then Terry's interview.
Do you worry about how much someone else drinks? Do you feel that if the drinker cared about you, he or she would stop drinking? It's not easy dealing with a loved one who drinks too much. Al-Anon family groups are for anyone affected by someone else's drinking. Before you can help the problem drinker, you need to help yourself first. For a meeting near you, call 1-888-4-Al-Anon, 1-888-425-2666. A message from Al-Anon Family Groups.
Okay, I am here at the Mystery Writers Conference in Sarasota, Florida, with Terry Griffin and his book right in front of me, Blood Island. And I don't know if you can hear it, but we're having a storm, and we are in a room that's all windows, and I can hear the rain and the wind, and so it's a perfect background for a discussion with a mystery writer.
It is. It is. You expect some dark character to come come into the room.
Exactly. So, Terry, I do an internet radio show, and I interview for the show people who make their life or their living with their art. And writers are always that, you know. And I like to ask, how did it happen to you? How did it capture you? How did you find it? How did it start?
Well, it's been a lifelong dream to write. I practiced law for 38 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So I was a very busy lawyer in Orlando, a trial lawyer. And when I retired, I actually started slowing down, moving toward retirement, I found time for the first time to write a little bit. And so I wrote my first book. It was successful. The second book was. The third book is this one, Blood Island, has really been good to me. It's gotten some national awards. And they're about to release the fourth one. So it's been sort of serendipitous, but it's been an interesting...
Well, there's nothing serendipitous about this. This is a whole hell of a lot of hard work. But when you said this was a lifelong dream, so I hear in that before you became a lawyer, you knew you might want to write. Is that accurate?
Oh, yeah.
So talk to me about the beginning, how you found words or writing or mysteries or...
Well, I've always been a big reader.
Uh-huh.
Since I first learned to read, reading was a passion. And I think most people who love to read would love to be able to write. I think it's kind of built into the system somehow. And I always thought I would like to do it. And I went in the Army when I was 17 and went overseas, and I did a lot of writing for my own amusement then. And
what kind?
Oh, just fictional stuff. I'd write a chapter of what might someday be a novel. Never did, but it was the kind of thing that I had a lot of time on my hands sometimes.
And a lot of ideas.
A lot of ideas. I was a kid in Europe in the Army. I was seeing things that a boy from Sanford, Florida never sees until they go into service. And there were a lot of ideas percolating up. And
were other guys writing?
No, most guys weren't. They were young soldiers, and I don't want to suggest I sat there and wrote. I did my share of beer drinking, too. I got out, started college. I was working usually two, sometimes three jobs while I'm at school. And just never had time to write. And
It never occurred to you to do it as a career then?
Oh, no. I knew it would be a very questionable way to make a living, I thought. And by the time I graduated from law school, I had a wife and a child, and I needed to make a living. And so I went back to Orlando to practice law.
And what kind of law?
I was a trial lawyer.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. Yeah. And what kind of, any kind of specialty, or just anybody who showed up?
We did. We had a small firm that specialized in civil litigation. So we'd try just about everything from bank problems, lender liability cases, real estate, contractual disputes, personal injury, medical malpractice.
Oh, this is a great training ground for somebody who's going to write mysteries.
Oh, I think so, but not maybe because of the reason you would think. One of the things I found about putting a lawsuit together is you have to be very meticulous in the way you do it. You have to always marshal your facts. You have to have a story based on those facts that a jury can understand. And writing a mystery is very much that way. You bring your facts together. You have to make it into a whole. You want to make sure you've got the facts straight so the blue car isn't green four chapters later. And you put it into a story that hopefully the reader is going to enjoy. And I think that's where the similarities come in.
So you're not using any of your cases in your books?
No. In fact, these are not legal. Actually, the first book I wrote was kind of a legal thriller. Matt Royal, who is a protagonist in the book, is a lawyer. But he's a retired lawyer living on Longboat Key in a condominium, drinking beer and chasing women and having a good time.
Oh.
Same kind of thing I would like to have done, except my wife would have killed me. Matt's a lawyer, but it's not a lawyer book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Matt is a guy that, he's a former soldier and former trial lawyer.
Not like anybody we know.
Well, that's about all the autobiographical part of it.
It's not vicarious, huh?
It is in the sense that, yeah, I wish I could have been like Matt Royal.
Well, you know, I think that's not an unusual way for a writer to approach a work. You know, either it is autobiographical or it's what I'd like to have been.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when I first started reading John D. McDonald's Travis McGee series back 40 years ago, the thing that struck me is that he's exactly what I wanted to be, and I could have been had I been about 6 inches taller, a little quicker, had a big houseboat, and could live by myself and have plenty of money. That's all I needed,
yes,
all those things.
All those things. I think everybody, well, I didn't want to be Travis. I wanted to be Meyer.
Well, you know, the John D. McDonald reportedly once said that Meyer was his autobiographical.
I met a guy once who said that he was compiling a list of Meyer's philosophies, which I just thought was a delightful idea. I've never seen it, so I don't know that he actually did it, but...
It would be, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, John D. McDonald had an MBA from Harvard.
I did.
And so his persona was much more toward Meyer, who was the
much
economist.
More philosophical.
Yeah.
But he must have had this urge.
I'm sure he did. To be Travis.
To be Travis, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, probably the preeminent John D. McDonald scholar is right here with us today, Cal Branch.
I didn't know.
Yes, I need to introduce you to him. Cal has made a lifelong study of John D. McDonald's works. He's going to run a panel tomorrow, as a matter of fact, with the title of the panel is John D. McDonald's Influence on the Modern Writer, and they're going to be, I guess, three of us. I'll be one of the panelists. We'll talk about how John D. McDonald had some influence on our writing.
Yeah. I'm thinking back how long ago I read them. They really are spectacular.
Oh, they are. Yeah, they're wonderful
books. They really are. Okay, so let me see if I get this right. You're a young man who's interested in reading and writing, but you are an American, so you know that you have to make a living for the wife and child you either are going to have or do have.
That's right.
And so you do what all the good boys do. You go to college and you become a lawyer, which is not everybody can do. And did you like it?
Love being a lawyer. It was a wonderful career. The law changed. The practice of law changed. And it went more, in the 38 years I did it, it moved from a profession into a real business. And I didn't like that part of it. But I started out practicing in a relatively small town of Orlando and ended up practicing in this metropolitan Orlando.
Yeah.
We went from 400 lawyers to 6,000 lawyers in Orange County during the time I practiced.
Oh my God.
So you had a huge change in the way the practice was done. But overall, I really did enjoy practicing law. I stumbled into it. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
How did that happen?
I was in college, and I really kind of realized that I probably ought to have an advanced degree of some sort. And I was thinking about going into the business world, and I was in school at Mercer University in Macon, Georgia. Had a fine old law school. Did not have a business school in those days. And I was married.
You were there.
I was there, and law school was only a year more, and I was pretty well convinced it was as good a launching platform in those days as an MBA. So I went to law school, and the first semester of law school, I fell in love with the law. Just absolutely, as an intellectual discipline, the most exciting thing I'd ever seen.
Wow.
And that stayed with me to this day. but I was ready to leave the practice too after 38 years. You know, you get to the point where you're afraid you start losing a step, and trial law is really a young man's business.
Yeah.
So it was time for me to go.
Yeah.
Go out when you're still
also
able to win.
Also, it wasn't what it had been.
It was. It was not. I write about that in the book. That's one of Matt Royal's, my character's problems, is he left the law practice because he got disgusted with the way it was being done.
Yeah. It's all billable hours.
It is. In fact, that's one of the things Matt said. It went from being
a mission.
A mission for your client to how many hours can you bill?
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And it's interesting because it in a way, I mean, this is way off the topic, but in a way, what you're talking about parallels what happened to our society, period.
Oh, I think so.
And why we're in the mess we're in now.
I think every profession has gone through that in the years that I've been in my adulthood. But I'll tell you one of the interesting things. I was talking to my wife about this the other day. The medical profession, which I've never had a whole lot of use for in terms of their anything about them, except they
occasionally
they do
they
what they're supposed to do,
right,
and what they
get
paid lots and lots of money to do. But the pendulum seems to be swinging in the medical profession the other way. Younger people coming in, they're more interested in what they're doing, particularly my wife's comment, I think she's right, the plethora of young female doctors has made that a more gracious business. And I think on the other side, we're seeing the law go more and more toward
masculine
arrogance. Well, actually, we over half the students in law school, they are women.
Wow.
But these women are coming out, arrogant as men.
And that's where they go.
Part of what has happened in our society over the last 30 years is we've been able to move away from that. Women are coming into professions and into business in droves. They're doing wonderful jobs. They're not having to out-mail the males.
Right.
They're
it's
coming
the
in.
Next generation.
It is.
No, it's not mine and yours.
Exactly.
Right.
When I was in law school in a class of 70, we had two women.
Yeah, right. And those women had to be tough.
They had to be tough. And neither one of them ended up practicing law.
Wow.
Now, I had dinner the other night with the dean of my law school, who is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And she was saying that 53% of their students are women there now. And that's been the norm for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that has been, I think, a really good change. But it's interesting that you see what I perceive as being women coming into the medical profession, moving it in the direction it ought to be going, and women coming into the legal profession, moving it in the wrong direction, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So it's kind of...
Well, I don't know, maybe this isn't accurate, but the women coming into the medical profession are moving the profession.
Mm-hmm.
Women going into the law are being moved by the law.
Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
You know, it's interesting. You know, there's probably a book in this.
Yeah, I don't think I'll write it.
Well, neither will I, so someone else is going to have to do it.
But yeah, I think the if you were going to manufacture a shrewish woman who has made it big in whatever profession or business, I mean, there's some of them out there, but you know, you look at so many of the women who are in charge of large corporations, and they are, they're not nasty,
no, mean, they're not
striving, they're hardworking people,
mm-hmm.
and they're very bright people, but they didn't feel like they had to leave their femininity at the door.
Yeah, no, that's right.
My daughter-in-law is one of those. She's a biochemist, very responsible, high-paying job. She's 34 years old. I'm very proud of her. I couldn't have asked for a better mother for my grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she's part of that new generation. But nobody ever told her she couldn't do anything.
Yeah, I want to say that I'm guessing about what kind of a man your son is and who he would have married. So, I mean, I'm talking to you.
He married his mother is what he did.
Yeah.
They don't look anything alike. But actually, my wife now, who was a quintessential housewife, because that was her generation, and once I got through school, she stayed home, took care of babies. But there's so many similarities in my daughter-in-law and my wife.
Yeah, right. And, you know, speaking as a therapist, if a man likes his parents, then he models his father and he marries his mother. Clearly you admired and valued your wife. So.
Oh, very much so.
And so does he.
Tomorrow is our 45th anniversary and I'm here and she's in Orlando. But if you're listening to this, honey, it's not that I don't value you.
I don't think she has to worry.
No.
Okay, I'd like to ask, is there anything I didn't ask you? Is there anything you want to say about making a life as a writer, as an artist?
I think I'll say this about my writing career. Thank goodness I don't have to make a living at it. It's a tough way to make a living. Most writers, good writers, good mid-list writers, are people who don't make a lot of money. Most of them probably still have a day jobs.
Did what you did.
Or they retire and they don't have to work anymore.
Right.
Now, you've got some of those up at the very top that make an awful lot of money, right?
Yeah, right.
But like anything else, that's a few at the top. But it's got to be generally very hard to start off writing, and you watch your sales build as your books get better known and you get more published.
And you still don't make that much more money.
Well, it does. It gets better and better, but not a whole lot.
Yeah,
better.
Right. Not good enough.
Yeah, not. I hate to have to rely on my income from books to put food on my table.
What's so interesting about this to me is that I ask this question to all kinds of artists, and almost everybody says exactly the same thing. The musicians say it, the painters say it, the actors say it. Don't do it for the money.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the and that's exactly the reason I didn't try to do it as a young man. It has just worked out that it's a wonderful second career.
Yes.
I'm having so much fun with it. It's hanging out with writers, that's a whole new thing for me.
I know.
We've got all these great guys here today for this conference, and they're a lot more fun to hang out with generally than lawyers.
Even those who were lawyers?
Well, because they've
changed.
They've changed.
Terry, this was great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me. Enjoyed it.
Well, there it is again. Don't give up your day gig. Don't do it for the money. Do it for the love. And, you know, if you've been listening to my show, you know that in this series, Anatomy of an Artist, which fills up the entire show this week, what I'm trying to do is demonstrate what it looks like when you are who you really are. My show is dedicated to the belief that most of us are keeping significant parts of ourselves in check, in undercover, or in denial for it. Maybe we don't even know it. And so we're cheating ourselves of so much that we could be and be enjoying. I didn't do it in this show because there's not enough time, but I spend the first part of the show talking about the kinds of things that get in our way from being who we really are. And the second half of the show, interviewing artists, people who make their life or their living with their art. Because as you can hear in both Wayne and Terry, when they are actually who they really are. You can hear in both of these men the attachment to this work, how much they love it, how much it is them. Even though both of these men had full-time careers before they were able to give themselves over to their first love, and both of them speak of it. They were writing when they were very young. They fell in love with words or stories or writing very, very young. The other thing I wonder if you could hear, I mentioned it at the beginning of the interview about the rain, but as I've been editing this interview, I hear it. It's pouring through most of our interview. And what was funny about that was when I arrived at the hotel, couple of hours before, sun was shining brightly. And when Terry and I started to do this interview, it was a typhoon. And then it just cleared right up. And that's Florida. If you've never been here, if you've never been in a Florida rain, then you probably don't know what I'm talking about, but it's so glorious. It's Mother Nature at her best. And actually, I'm going to have to stop doing this in a moment because I can see that we're soon going to have a thunderstorm. I probably couldn't have done the interview. The thunderstorm goes loud. Oh, my God. But before I close this show, I want to say what I always say, which is thank you, thank you, thank you, Josh Hackney, the man who has made this show possible by coming and making sure that the sound all works, fixing whatever I have done wrong, finding things for me that I cannot figure out how to find, explaining how to do things that the learning curve of which I cannot get. And to tell you, as I always do, that if you have any of these needs, you want Josh, and to go up on my website, thelynshow.com, and that's thelynne.com. Don't leave the E out. There is another The Lynn Show. You won't get either me or Josh there. And as always, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show. Something interesting, something compelling, something you didn't know, something you knew but had forgotten, something motivating, inspirational, even annoying, but something that brings you back, something that makes you want to tune in next week. I'm going to be playing another two interviews that I did at the Florida Mystery Writers Convention. So if you're interested in writing, if you're interested in mysteries, if you're interested in art, if you're interested in what it sounds like to be who you really are, then please do tune in, because I will be here, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten